waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, we always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma Al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month, an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's foreign minister's trip to Mali has come to an end. Amir Abdullahian and his Malian counterpart, Abdoulaye Diop, hailed their meeting as constructive, hoping that their negotiations would help develop bonds of friendship between the two nations.
We made an agreement with Mali's foreign minister and the head of the country's transitional government to take bigger steps in the coming months in various areas, including the activities of knowledge-based companies and transfer of technology in this field, as well as defense cooperation to help boost peace, stability, and security in this country.
Both sides are more dedicated than ever to taking the next steps to deepen ties.
The trip to Mali marked Amir Abdullahian's first visit to an African nation during his time in office as Iran's foreign minister. He then departed Bamako for his next destination, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city, an industrial hub which is home to the country's main port. Upon arrival at Dar es Salaam's international airport, Tanzanian Foreign Minister Liberata Mulamula warmly welcomed his Iranian counterpart.
We are delighted to have this high-level visit. And while he's here, I know His Excellency has only a few days, but we'd like him to see Tanzania and be able to visit Zanzibar and visit the capital. So we are really excited. We are also excited that he's coming with the business group. So we'll have a business forum. So we want also to thank the ambassador here for organizing this. So to you all, we say karibu sana.
Amir Abdullahian, for his part, thanked his counterpart for hosting the top diplomat and his accompanying delegation, as well as governmental and private sector representatives.
There are lots of opportunities for developing Iran-Tanzania relations, particularly in the fields of mining and energy. Iran's top diplomat will take part in a business forum and also visit the country's top officials to explore potential for boosting bilateral cooperation. Mahdi Abbasian, Dar es Salaam.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight. The cost of energy for British consumers will rise by 80% from October. That's according to electricity and gas regulator Ofgem. This is indeed a dramatic worsening of the cost of living crisis in a country that is awaiting a new leader. And now stark warnings have been issued of a catastrophe and serious physical and financial damage to British families in the winter. Other major European economies are also witnessing similar economic woes, with German and French electricity prices hitting new records. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll try to explore the reasons behind the deepening energy crisis in Europe and its repercussions. Joining us on the program tonight, we have Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. And we also have senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute at London Metropolitan University, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Doctorow in Brussels. The UK government has announced an 80% rise in electricity and gas bills amid a cost of living crisis. Electricity and gas regulator Ofgem, as we mentioned in our intro, says it will increase its main cap on consumer energy bills to $4,200 per year from the current $2,300. It just continues to get worse for the UK. What do you see as the underlying reasons and causes for the UK's economic troubles?
No, they're self-caused. I think the British took pride in probably being the most green economy in Europe. That is to say, they put great reliance on renewables, on wind power, which in the past year has proved to be a very poor investment because the winds were not favorable and power generated was much less than expected. And they have put nearly all of their electricity into gas, which is green in a way. Unfortunately, they didn't anticipate the shortage of gas on the world market because of the sanctions that they and European powers have imposed on Russia and Russia's response. The Europeans said, we won't take gas, we're going to cut back our reliance on Russian gas, and the Russians said, all right, then we can start cutting back right now. And they have done so, seriously reducing the amount of gas that's flowing into Europe. Now, the cost to the consumer that you mentioned at the outset is real. And in the case of Britain, they are adjusting their price cap every 3 months. The latest projections go out to the end of the year, the start of the new year. However, it has to be said that the British government also has announced plans. This is Johnson has announced plans to provide subsidies directly to consumers, depending on their wage categories and special circumstances, such as a health condition and the rest. In the case of Europe, the same tenfold increase over last year in the price of electricity is announced in the French newspapers today. So the situation is generalized because the shortage of gas is generalized for the reasons I outlined at the beginning.
George Samueli in Budapest, anti-poverty campaigners are warning of a catastrophe and serious physical and financial damage to British families. Britons are also grappling with soaring food prices and an inflation that's now at a 40-year high of over 10%. The Resolution Foundation has urged radical measures to prevent a catastrophe this winter. What are these radical measures, in your opinion?
Well, I think as Mr. Doctorow has pointed out, I mean, there are obviously price caps and subsidies of the kind that they practiced during the COVID era. And there's no question. I mean, the outlook for small businesses in the UK is indeed quite shocking. I read a story today that British pubs are claiming that some 70% of them are not going to survive this winter. Many small businesses do not expect to survive this winter. So it is an absolutely catastrophic increases in energy. And of course, that's hitting all households way beyond anything that is affordable by most people. So that's just in the UK. But in Europe, but again, it's an absolutely appalling mess. And, you know, the political leaders have so far responded with the notion that, well, we have to make these sacrifices. And then if you ask, well, sacrifices for what? Then they say, well, the sacrifices for Ukraine. But of course, they don't really explain why should ordinary people have to make these sacrifices for Ukraine. They never really made any decision at any time that imposing sanctions against Russia was the way to go. This was decided by unelected elites, and ordinary people in the UK and in Europe are paying the price.
Mr. Doctorow, British people believe the worst is yet to come, and the impact of the increase in consumer energy bills will hit them the hardest in the winter. NHS Confederation says that many Britons this winter could face, quote, the awful choice between eating and heating. How worried should an average British citizen be right now with this outlook?
Well, I think he should focus his mind not on what handouts the British government may or may not give to him and his family, but to focus his mind on what political action he should take in the streets and in his labor unions to look after his own interests and to counter politically a suicidal policy by his government with respect to energy and energy imports from Russia. I think we will see the various European countries reacting very differently in terms of the social protests that will arise, just as the various governments are going to go in very different directions, despite all the talk coming from the European Commission about solidarity. We've had seen in the last week what solidarity means in gas procurement, in the competition for Algerian gas between the Italians and the French, with Mr. Macron being in Algeria this week, not just to celebrate or to renew their long-term cooperation, but the hope that they would provide more gas, especially to France. The result was he missed the boat. The boat has already sailed to Italy. So there will be a lot of competition between the European governments, and there will be various reactions among their populations according to the political activity and labor strength in each country.
George Samueli, throughout all of the difficulties that Britons are facing, labor is criticizing the Tories, saying all of this is a result of 12 years of their government. How much do you see the Tory leadership being responsible, and did they fail to prepare for this day, in your opinion?
Well, yes, but I think that that's true of all of the Europeans. They had, for years and years, they had neglected investing in fossil fuels. They thought, hey, this is passé, you know, we're going to move on into renewables. They had absolutely bungled their relations on regard to energy with Russia. Instead of securing long-term contracts, which the Russians preferred, they wanted to bet everything on the spot market. They thought they could make better deals on purchasing gas on the spot market. It turned out they made an absolutely disastrous decision, and so they're paying far more for the gas. This is even before February the 24th. They're paying far more for the gas than they would have done had they signed long-term contracts with Russia. And then, of course, they compounded it all with all manner of decisions on sanctions. I mean, the coal, they've already banned all coal imports from Russia. They now intend to ban all oil imports from Russia by the end of the year. The Nord Stream 2, this gas pipeline that they spent years building, then Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced, again, before February the 24th and the start of the special military operation, Chancellor Olaf Scholz said, "Now that's it, we're closing down Nord Stream 2. So Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which could have provided gas for Europe, and, you know, has been shut down. And, of course, now everything is dependent on Nord Stream 1, and now even that is a problematic because of all the issues with the compressors, routine maintenance, and of course now gas imports are down very substantially from what they were before. And you know, the Europeans really have very little resort. I mean, they can talk about, oh, well, we're going to move towards liquefied natural gas, but that's a big investment. That's going to take a long time for Europe to be able to switch to liquefied natural gas. So it's a series of decisions that they made, and including, I should also say, that during the time of the COVID shutdowns, they didn't replenish their natural gas stock, so that when the economy started recovering from the COVID, then there wasn't enough gas to fuel things. So it's a series of decisions, and that's why we are where we are.
Mr. Doctorow, the head of the electricity and gas regulator, Ofgem, has urged the next British Prime Minister, who will be elected next month, to take decisive action in accordance with what he called the upcoming fuel crisis. Now, we know that whoever wins the race for Prime Minister in September will have a whole lot to deal with. The outgoing Prime Minister Boris Johnson is insisting that major fiscal decisions would be left to his successor. When a new Prime Minister comes, will there be enough time to try to deal with this looming fuel crisis? And let's not forget the looming recession.
Well, we've focused on the consumer impact as expressed in the cost of electricity and gas warehouses, or housing is being heated by gas in Britain, which is the dominant situation. We have not spoken about the impact on industry generally. The same newspapers that were reporting today in Britain on the caps being put on electricity prices were reporting relaying information from the Association of Fertilizer Producers that production is going down by 70% because of the uneconomic costs of gas inputs into their production. Across the board, wherever there is manufacturing, and there's not that much manufacturing in the UK, but still it is important for their agriculture to have fertilizer. Wherever there is other economic activity, the gas, constricted gas supply, is going to have a dramatic effect both on jobs in manufacturing and on the cost of food products, which are dependent on fertilizers. So we have only looked at and spoken about so far one dimension of a general economic challenge that this leadership in Britain on the continent is incapable of dealing with. They are unprofessional. They have been big talkers, but they haven't gotten serious advice, or they haven't taken seriously the knowledge that is held by their own energy industry. Mr. Novikov, who for more than 10 years was the Russian Minister of Energy, said at the beginning of this latest crisis, just at the outset of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, that there would be enormous increase in the price of petrol, that there would be enormous price increases in electricity, and no one was particularly listening to him on the continent or in Britain, because they were big talkers who said they could solve the problem by networking, by going out, in the case of Mr. Schultz, all over the world, to Canada most recently, to secure energy to replace the Russians. That was all big talk, but it was ignoring the realities of the marketplace. These people are not supposed to be capitalist society, but they have no respect for the intelligence and the expertise of their own industrialists.
Mr. Doctor, I'm going to stay with you for a second here. We can't look at Britain's economic situation now without mentioning Brexit and its disruptions in trade. Is the UK still feeling the ripple effects of leaving the Union, and is there still more to come from that divorce?
Well, there certainly is more to come if Truss becomes the next Prime Minister, because she said one of her first acts will be to rip up the agreements pertaining to Northern Ireland. With that, she will exacerbate enormously the trade conflicts that Britain has been experiencing over the last couple of years. And this will become a genuine trade war, which Britain can ill afford to engage in. So the British are shooting themselves in the foot by attractive campaign talk to get a very conservative lady, someone modeling herself on the Iron Lady of Thatcher, into the Prime Minister's office. And they're not considering the impact on their day-to-day living and on their expenses. Transportation is always a major factor in the cost of goods and in the cost of, particularly in the cost of agricultural supplies coming in from abroad. They will be exacerbated by trade frictions and delays at the border that Britain will experience if Truss is elected and she follows through on her promises to disrupt the agreements over Northern Ireland.
Mr. Samueli, many blame the UK's economic troubles primarily on the situation in Ukraine, specifically the energy crisis and fuel poverty. How much of this is due to the consequences of the Ukraine war, and not just in the UK, but in all of Europe as well? Power prices continue to soar in several European countries, hitting new records, specifically in Germany and France.
Well, I think it's a very important aspect of it all. I mean, if you make a decision that you're not going to import oil from Russia by the end of the year, you ban coal imports, and then you close down Nord Stream 2 pipeline, then you really are, you know, in a real pickle. And they really don't have any means of resolving this problem. So when Viktor Orban, the Hungarian prime minister, says, well, you know, we're basically just not just shooting ourselves in the foot, we are essentially shooting ourselves in the heart and lungs. And then he went off, or rather he sent off his foreign minister to Moscow to sign an agreement for an additional, I think, 700 million cubic meters of natural gas. He was acting in the interest of Hungary, but the EU leadership was indignant and outraged by this because he wasn't showing solidarity. But why should Hungary or any other country show solidarity when Europe has undertaken a very foolish policy? I mean, they imagined that they would be able to bring the Russian economy to its knees and that they wouldn't suffer more than Russia. But as it turned out, they didn't bring the Russian economy to its knees. The ruble is doing extremely well, and they are suffering much more than the Russian economy is suffering, because it all goes to show, and they, who supposedly understand economics, the EU leaders, did not understand that a producer, a country like Russia that produces oil, coal, gas, grain, fertilizers, has all the power over the consumer. And they somehow thought, well, we're consumers, we're just going to boycott their goods, and they're going to crash to their knees, and we're going to do very nicely. Well, that's turned out to be nonsensically. And so, therefore, I think a number of countries, Hungary obviously is just basically wants very little to do with this regime, but Italy could be next. There could be a change in government in September, a new kind of right-wing populist government could take power, and they could well just simply say, you know, we've had it with these sanctions, we're not going to live in poverty, you know, this is Europe, you know, we're supposed to be the sort of the prosperous island in the world, and, you know, why should we do this for Ukraine?
Mr. Doctorow, focusing on Europe, the European Union has announced an energy crisis summit at the earliest possible date. Does Europe have the fortitude, in your opinion, to handle this crisis right now?
Well, it's too early to give a sound answer to that. The fortitude of its leaders will be tested by their own peoples. If there is nothing but such sullen resentment, if people sit in their kitchens and complain about the cost of living, then, of course, this group of pompous so-called leaders will prevail. If, however, in one or more countries, as is highly probable, there will be demonstrations, there will be riots, and it's entirely possible when we speak about the level of suffering that will follow from these price increases. If these disturbances occur, then we will be able to see a very different situation, and that will be a renunciation of these foolhardy policies that have been put in place by the European Commission and followed blindly by the 27 member states who believe wrongly that there is strength in unity. In this case, there is weakness in unity when unity is behind an unprofessional, ill-thought-through set of policies with respect to energy.
Mr. Samueli, London's tube and bus workers staged walkouts over pay and conditions. Teachers, lawyers, nurses, postal staff, as well as aviation workers have moved towards strike action as well. And similar strike actions were seen across other European countries. Help us better understand the impact that these major walkouts could have overall.
Well, the walkouts are understandable. Inflation in the UK is currently estimated as 10%. It's expected to rise to 13% by October and 18% by next January. So when you have inflation rate of 18%, while your pay raise, whatever pay raise you get, is 3 or 4%, that means you're taking essentially a 15% pay cut. Well, people don't take kindly to 15% pay cuts when, at the same time, food prices, energy costs, and everything is going up. There will indeed be strikes. I mean, that's what happens when people are suddenly taking a dramatic pay cut. And I think that's going to happen in Europe and in Germany also for the first time. Imagine, you know, this is a country that, you know, if you had 1% inflation, the Germans would get hysterical, you know, Hitler's coming. Now they're kind of living with 8% inflation. And now that the Germans are talking about rationing gas for industry, well, that means they're going to be layoffs, and that means pay cuts. In Germany, they do kind of partial layoffs. They don't fire people. They just, you know, give them fewer hours to work. But that means effectively it's pay cuts. Well, people don't take kindly to pay cuts even in Germany, you know, who are much more docile than the British. So I would imagine that the combination of inflation,
sure,
recession, and soaring electricity costs will, you know, contribute. This will be a bitter winter. This will be a real winter of discontent.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Gilbert Docter, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels. Also, senior research fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Samueli, joining us from Budapest. Thank you for contributing to the program. And also, special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight. Over the course of this summer, the nation has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. The piece is titled "Donald Trump is Not Above the Law," and it's been written by the editorial board of the newspaper. Over the course of this summer, America has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The Justice Department remained largely silent about its investigations of the former president until this month, when the FBI searched his home in Palm Beach, Florida, in a case related to his handling of classified documents. The spectacle of a former president facing criminal investigation raises profound questions about American democracy, and these questions demand answers. Donald Trump's unprecedented assault on the integrity of American democracy requires a criminal investigation. The disturbing details of his post-election malfeasance, meticulously assembled by the January 6th committee, leave little doubt that Mr. Trump sought to subvert the Constitution and overturn the will of the American people. The president, defeated at the polls in 2020, tried to enlist federal law enforcement authorities, state officials, and administrators of the nation's electoral system in a furious effort to remain in power. When all else failed, he roused an armed mob that stormed the Capitol and threatened lawmakers. The Justice Department is reportedly examining Mr. Trump's conduct, including his role in trying to overturn the election and in taking home classified documents. If Attorney General Merrick Garland and his staff conclude that there is sufficient evidence to establish Donald Trump's guilt on a serious charge in a court of law, then they must seek an indictment too. This board is aware that in deciding how Donald Trump should be held accountable under the law, it is necessary to consider not just whether criminal prosecution would be warranted, but whether it would be wise. No American president has ever been criminally prosecuted after leaving office. When President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he ensured that Nixon would not be prosecuted for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford explained his decision with the warning that such a prosecution posed grave risks of rousing ugly passions and worsening political polarization. That warning is just as salient today. Pursuing prosecution of Donald Trump could further entrench support for him and play into the conspiracy theories he has sought to stoke. It could inflame the bitter partisan divide, even to the point of civil unrest. A trial, if it is viewed as illegitimate, could also further undermine confidence in the rule of law, whatever the eventual outcome. The risks of political escalation are obvious. The Democratic and Republican parties are already in the thick of a cycle of retribution that could last generations. There is a substantial risk that, if the Justice Department does prosecute Donald Trump, future presidents, whether Mr. Trump himself or someone of his ilk, could misuse the precedent to punish political rivals. If their party takes a majority in the House of Representatives after the midterm elections, some Republicans have already threatened to impeach President Biden. There is an even more immediate threat of further violence,
and it is a possibility that Americans should, sadly, be prepared for. In the hours after federal agents began a court-approved search of Donald Trump's residence in Palm Beach, based on a warrant investigating possible violations of three federal laws, including one that governs the handling of defense information under the Espionage Act, his most fervent supporters escalated their rhetoric to the language of warfare. As the New York Times noted, the aggressive widespread response was arguably the clearest outburst of violent public rhetoric since the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Merrick Garland has been deliberate, methodical, and scrupulous in his leadership of the Justice Department's investigation of the January 6 attack and the transfer of documents to Donald Trump's home. On Friday, a redacted version of the affidavit used to obtain the warrant was released, revealing that the Justice Department asked to search the premises to recover documents because of concerns that their disclosure could compromise clandestine human sources of intelligence, and because it had probable cause to believe it would find evidence of obstruction at the premises. No matter how careful Merrick Garland is, or how measured the prosecution might be, there is a real and significant risk from those who believe that any criticism of Donald Trump justifies an extreme response. Yet, it is a far greater risk to do nothing when action is called for. Aside from letting Mr. Trump escape punishment, doing nothing to hold him accountable for his actions in the months leading up to the January 6 assault could set an irresistible precedent for future presidents. Why not attempt to stay in power by any means necessary or use the power of the office to enrich oneself or punish one's enemies, knowing that the law does not apply to presidents in or out of office? More importantly, democratic government is an ideal that must constantly be made real. America is not sustained by a set of principles. It is sustained by resolute action to defend those principles. Immediately after the January 6th insurrection, cabinet members reportedly debated privately whether to remove Donald Trump from power under the authority of the 25th Amendment. A week after the attack, the House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time. This editorial board supported his impeachment and removal from office. We also suggested that the former president and lawmakers who participated in the January 6th plot could be permanently barred from holding office under a provision of the 14th Amendment that applies to any official who has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to those who have done so. But most Republicans in the Senate refused to convict Donald Trump, and Congress has yet to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment against him. As a result, the threat that Donald Trump and his most ardent supporters pose to American democracy has metastasized. Even now, the former president continues to spread lies about the 2020 election and denounce his vice president, Mike Pence, for not breaking the law on his behalf. Meanwhile, dozens of people who believe Mr. Trump's lies are running for state and national elected office. Many have already won, some of them elevated to positions that give them control over how elections are conducted. In June, the Republican Party in Texas approved measures in its platform declaring that Mr. Biden's election was illegitimate. And Donald Trump appears prepared to start a bid for a second term as president. Mr. Trump's actions as a public official, like no other since the Civil War, attack the heart of our system of government. He used the power of his office to subvert the rule of law. If we hesitate to call those actions and their perpetrator criminal, then we are saying he's above the law and giving license to future presidents to do whatever they want. In addition to a federal investigation by the Justice Department, Donald Trump is facing a swirl of civil and criminal liability in several other cases. A lawsuit by the Attorney General for the District of Columbia over payments during his inauguration ceremonies. A criminal investigation in Westchester County, New York, over taxes on one of his golf courses. A criminal case in Fulton County, Georgia, over interference in the 2020 presidential election. A criminal case by the Manhattan District Attorney over the valuation of Mr. Trump's properties. And a civil inquiry by New York's Attorney General into Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. The specific crimes the Justice Department could consider would likely involve Mr. Trump's fraudulent efforts to get election officials in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere to declare him the winner, even though he lost in those states. To get Mike Pence, at the 6th of January congressional certification of the election, to throw out slates of electors from states he lost and replace them with electors loyal to Mr. Trump. And to enlist officials from the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, to persuade officials in certain states to swing the election to him and ultimately stir up a mob that attacked the Capitol. The government could also charge Mr. Trump with seditious conspiracy, a serious charge that federal prosecutors have already brought against leaders of far-right militia groups who participated in the Capitol invasion. The committee hearings make it clear Mr. Trump must have known he was at the center of a frantic, sprawling, and knowingly fraudulent effort that led directly to the Capitol siege. For hours, Donald Trump refused to call off the mob. The testimony from hundreds of witnesses, many of them high-ranking Republican officials from his own administration, reveals Donald Trump's unrelenting efforts, beginning months before Election Day and continuing through 6th of January, to sow doubt about the election, to refuse to accept the result of that election, and then to pursue what he must have known were illegal and unconstitutional means to overturn it. Many participants sought preemptive pardons for their conduct, an indication that they knew very well that they were violating the law. Other evidence points to other crimes like obstruction of Congress, defined as a corrupt obstruction of the proper administration of the law. The fake elector scheme that Mr. Trump and his associates pushed before January 6 appears to meet this definition. That may explain why at least three of Mr. Trump's campaign lawyers were unwilling to participate in the plot. People involved in it were told it was not legally sound by White House lawyers, but they moved forward with it anyway. Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows, provided powerful evidence that could be used to charge Donald Trump with seditious conspiracy. In her public testimony at a January 6 committee hearing, Cassidy Hutchinson said that Mr. Trump was informed that many in the throng of supporters waiting to hear him speak on the ellipse on that day were armed, but that he demanded that they be allowed to skip the metal detectors that had been installed for his security. "They're not here to hurt me," he said, according to Ms. Hutchinson. "Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here." If Merrick Garland decides to pursue prosecution, a message that the Justice Department must send early and often is that even if Mr. Trump genuinely believed, as he claimed, that the election had been marred by fraud, his schemes to interfere in the certification of the vote would still be crimes. And even though Mr. Trump's efforts failed, these efforts would still be crimes. More than 850 other Americans have already been charged with crimes for their roles in the Capitol attack. Well-meaning intentions did not shield them from the consequences of their actions. it would be unjust if Donald Trump, the man who inspired them, faced no consequences. No one should revel in the prospect of this or any former president facing criminal prosecution. Donald Trump's actions have brought shame on America and destabilized its future. Even justice before the law will not erase that stain. Nor will prosecuting Mr. Trump fix the structural problems that led to the greatest crisis in American democracy since the Civil War. But it is a necessary first step toward doing so.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.